Since its release in 1982, The Artist's Guide to Sketching has become a classic art guide for students and laypeople around the world. The book includes instruction and artwork by James Gurney and Thomas Kincaid, two students who would go on to fame. For James Gurney, it was Dinotopia, and for Kincaid, it was Painter of Light. Now there is a bold new edition of the groundbreaking book, freshly updated with a new introduction, archival photographs, and illuminating text to guide a new generation of illustrators. James Gurney is our guest. He's a dear friend of this program. He's an artist and author best known for his New York Times bestselling book series, Dinotopia, detailing a fantastical world where humans and dinosaurs coexist. His original oil paintings have been shown in over 35 one-man exhibitions in museums such as the Smithsonian, the Norman Rockwell Museum, and the Delaware Art Museum. And it's a great pleasure to welcome James Gurney back to the roundtable. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Joe. Good to be back.
It's really wonderful to have you back. I thank you so much for your time and for being here and coming up from the Hudson Valley and to tell us about this cool book that has been around for a long time. I'm curious as to what you were thinking initially to say, okay, this is what we want to put out into the world that perhaps will help people learn how to sketch.
Well, it was a crazy idea because Tom Kincaid and I were friends and roommates going back to UC Berkeley when we were 17. And at Art Center, we went on to art school. But we got tired of sitting in windowless classrooms, listening to these kind of art teachers droning on about art theory. We said, let's drop out of art school. Let's hitch the freight trains across America, like John Steinbeck or, you know, Woody Guthrie. And we'll write a book about it and see what happens. So we rode the freights. We made it to New York City. We were sleeping on rooftops and graveyards. And we decided, here's a book idea. So we found the best publisher we could, Watson Guptill, went in there and we said we were wearing uniforms, matching uniforms with gas station T-shirts, you know, and our names and American flags on there. And we said, we have this idea for this book, and they agreed to do it.
So and I guess, what did you think the market was of the interest that so many people had that they could sketch? That it would be something that they would be able to employ into their life and be able to do.
Well, what we meant by sketching was just drawing from life, not necessarily quick, loose sketches or doodles, but really serious, comprehensive drawings done from observation of animals, of places, of people. And we wanted to write this book to tell the stories we were encountering, the people we were encountering. And we wanted to talk about what it's like to be on the spot, to sketch people from life and have them tell you their story and have you see places that you never would have seen. We went to, for example, the foxhound trials in Missouri, and we met the Ernie Caldwell, who is the guy who won most of the trophies. And it was an amazing experience, but it was an experience that happened because we were sketching. So it opens doors to experience.
It almost seems in that explanation that there was the search of the art, but there was also a search for a meaning for you and what you wanted to do with your life.
Yeah, and we didn't have a concept of the audience because in those days in 1980 when we were traveling, we had no fans, we had no community, we had no followers. Like people now, you're very conscious of your readership, but we didn't know. We only got, when the book came out in 1982, we only got like 3 fan letters, and that's it. That's the only contact we had with our readers.
But you knew, this is what most people say, James, you know this, of course, is that, you know, you write the book that you wish somebody had written for you, and there's some truth to that for you as well, for you and Tom.
Yeah, when you write a book, you learn a subject. And having been through college and written papers, I think the writing seemed to me a little sophomoric when I went back on it, but it's actually quite thorough because we cover all the topics and materials you need. We were using basic things like markers and pens and pencils, mainly black and white, because I couldn't really paint yet. I was new as a painter, but I drew a lot in my childhood, and I wanted to just draw in black and white what we saw. And there were a few paintings in color that we did, in watercolor and gouache, and those are now, in the new edition, are reproduced in full color, which is a nice addition.
It's such a beautiful, it's just a beautiful book to look at, and the color is so gorgeous. Talk about the individual styles that you each had. I assume you learn from each other. Tom, of course, has passed, very sadly, but has passed. But over those many years of working, of what you learned from each other.
Yeah, we were an interesting pair of friends because we each had something for the other person to complete their personality. Like, I needed someone who was bolder and more outgoing, and Tom was like, he was a salesman. He was kind of a provocateur and a daring, crazy guy. You never knew what he was going to do or say next. And he's the one who really had the idea for this trip. But we, as far as styles, we were just trying everything. We were trying loose, sketchy styles, trying to capture moving objects. I went to a boxing match in L.A., where I had to figure out a way to try to capture this high-powered action in this sweaty environment. So I used charcoal on a rag, and I dragged that along for the line of action and erased out from there to try to build the forms and just built it out that way. But I didn't really have a template for how to do this. There were no books on this subject, on how to draw moving subjects before, so we had to really invent it as we went.
When do you know that you have, like, using that as an example, that you have it right? Because you have a whole section in the book about achieving accuracy. So when you are doing that of the motion, that you have achieved that accuracy?
Well, you can kind of tell when a sketch works, when you really capture something essential about something. We had generated literally hundreds of sketches, and we covered the floor of our apartment building in Los Angeles, where we lived, with all these sketches and picked out the best ones to put in the book. But we had a lot of other ones that were unpublished. And along the way, you know, we had a lot of sketches of parking lots and museum sketches of animals that were, you know, stuffed animals or taxidermied animals, and people that we had met along the way.
I'm looking, you do have, there's tigers and camels and dogs. I mean, there's a great number of animals, and animals can be very useful in that, not only in movement, but in sort of capturing their own individuality.
Yeah. And I was interested in animation at the time, and I even tried to get a job at Disney. They turned me down at the time, and I did end up getting a job after getting some painting experience doing background paintings for Ralph Bakshi. He's the guy who did Fritz the Cat.
Yeah,
and I worked with him on Fire and Ice, along with Thomas Kinkade, who painted the other half of the backgrounds. So this was where we really learned to paint, much more than we learned in art school, because we had to paint 11 paintings per week. These are background paintings. Some of them are quick, sketchy paintings, but other ones were establishing shots, you know. So we had to really paint like madmen. This is after we returned from our freight train adventure across America. So we were both working on the book here and also working on this movie. And we had to go into the director, Ralph Bakshi, and say, "Hey, Ralph, we got this book contract and we got to work on this book. So do you mind if we take 3-day weekends and a little time off, a little more time off than we thought we'd need? We'll put in the time for the backgrounds, don't worry." And he was very upset at first, but then he realized there's a good book out of this, and so he supported us after that.
Did you learn, how do I put this? Did you learn enough about animation that you knew that perhaps it wasn't where you would spend your career?
Yeah, later, after working on For Fire and Ice, I got an offer from Disney to work as a layout artist there. But I turned that down because I realized I had met Frank Frazetta, who did a lot of paperback covers.
Yep.
There was a future there for doing covers, which is what I did all through the 80s.
Did a lot of sci-fi work.
Sci-fi work for National Geographic, yep, doing archaeological paintings. And I was an archaeology major at UC Berkeley, so working on archaeology was really my bread and butter. So with them, I traveled on location to all these different exotic places, like, well, we went to northern Italy for a story on the Etruscans. And that is what gave me the ideas ultimately for Dinotopia. And it's no accident that Dinotopia is framed as kind of a explorer sketchbook, because that was based on the journal of sketching that we had done cross-country. Dinotopia is kind of the same thing. It's an explorer, but exploring a fantasy world where dinosaurs are still alive.
You spent time in natural history museums, so I assume you were doing some of your first dinosaurs then too, right?
Yeah. I was just starting to get interested in dinosaurs. I was not as a kid that interested, but by then, by the 80s and 90s, there were new discoveries in dinosaurs that were just thrilling, like the idea that they had feathers or the idea that they were warm-blooded, and that changed everything for me in that project. But that came 10 years after this one came out.
It's an expanded and remastered edition of the classic The Artist's Guide to Sketching by James Gurney and Thomas Kincaid, the classic book about making art on location. And James Gurney is our guest this morning. You still sketch most every day?
Yeah, I probably sketch more in gouache or paint, watercolor, than I do in pencil and pen, although I do both. We were out there a few years ago on the Hudson River sketching ice boats, but with gouache, you got a problem if it's below freezing. It tends to freeze up on the brush. So if you mix isopropyl alcohol or Everclear grain alcohol, you can keep the gouache from freezing. So we went out there and sketched. My wife is also a painter.
Yeah.
We met in art school. She's on the cover of the book, actually. And she kind of got me into watercolor. I did a lot of stuff in oil, but watercolor and gouache are wonderful. And that's one of the next books I'm working on, is about gouache painting. Gouache is opaque watercolor.
But it's still sketching.
I still call it sketching because it's working from life. And maybe a better word for this is painting or drawing from life. And it's become quite an interest among artists since the book came out. In the about 2006 or so, this movement of urban sketching took off.
Yep.
And that started from a sketch journalist in Seattle who had this idea of getting an online movement of people to sketch and then meet up afterwards. So it's very much a communal social event. There's also the plein air painting movement, which started thanks to a guy named Eric Rhodes, who organizes gatherings and meetups for people who paint, usually from oil, from life. So this idea of painting from life was not popular when we wrote the book, and we were like the only guys doing it. But now, since then, it's taken off as a pretty viable energizer for the realist art movement.
I was, over the years, one time I was with you and you had a sketchbook with you, and you were doing something out here on Central Avenue in Albany. And I remember thinking, okay, so is it something in that case? So you've got maybe 45 minutes to kill, before you're on the radio. Is that something that you want to do, or something that you find relaxing in a way, or something that you want to capture a moment that seems interesting?
All of the above.
Okay.
It's a centering and kind of a relaxing experience for me to sit and stop and focus my attention on one thing. I think now one reason this book has really taken off for us is that it's landing at a time when people are on their computers so much and dealing with AI and all these other things that kind of take you away from that simple connection with the world around you. And sketching and journaling are the two ways that you can really focus your attention and have fun observing, learning something. And when you're sketching from life, very often people who know something about what you're doing will come up to you and say, oh, I had that old tractor and that thing needs a
sure.
new hydraulic cylinder
yeah.
or whatever. And then you're off on an adventure, which Tom and I called hoisting. That was a word we made up for this mix of adventuring and sketching, which we found we were always mixed up in. We went to in Donovan, Missouri, where we were staying. went to what they called the Sin Center, which was really the snooker parlor and pinball parlor in town. And we met the kind of guys, Gary and Doug, that lived there. And that led us on a whole series of adventures, shooting 10-gauge shotguns off the back of someone's porch and just crazy stuff like that that we never would have happened to us if we hadn't been sketching.
So let me ask what I think is a complex question, but I'm curious again about it. One of the sketches you once sent me was of our Central Avenue, and which is right out here. It's where we're located in Albany, New York. And it was on a gray, rainy day, and that was evident within the sketch. I would look, and one of the things that about this is how realistic and how beautiful the things are. You have a train car on the cover, or a storefront, and how accurate they are. What fascinated me is that in that incredibly accurate, amazing sketch was that there was a beauty that I didn't see and I don't see when I'm walking down Central Avenue.
Yeah, I see that too when I look at sketches of people I admire. And I think part of that beauty just comes from filtering through someone's consciousness the experience of the world. I mean, it's more than a photograph would. A sketch will allow you to, as a viewer, to experience something of the way that the mind of the artist is looking at a subject. And it just makes a commonplace subject come alive. Like one of the things I love to paint recently is snow piles and parking lots.
Mm.
These are the things that the big plows push up in the
right
corners of the parking lots. But when the light hits them, they look like Mount Everest in their own way. And I love painting those things and just capturing a different aspect of light and shade. But people really respond to those things, and I think it's one part of our ordinary world that most artists overlook when they look for bucolic or pastoral or picturesque scenes. There's a beauty in the commonplace world, in jukeboxes and in parking lots and laundromats that otherwise would be overlooked and forgotten. And I think it's important for us as artists to not miss that.
So, again, I think this, if I were to be asked this question, I think it would be almost impossible to answer, but I'm curious of what your thought is. So what is it when you look, when you're walking and you see, what is it, do you have a sense of what it is that catches your eye?
I think that's one of the toughest questions. I do a lot of YouTube videos.
Yes.
And talk about kind of what goes through my mind as I do sketches. And the choice of the motif has to do with a lot of factors. How close the bathroom is, where you can get a cup of coffee. I mean, practical stuff like that.
Sure.
Where you're safe. There's some that I've had to bail on because it wasn't safe to be sitting on this busy street corner or something.
Sure.
But often it's a preconceived idea of lighting that I'm looking for or color I'm looking for. Other times I'm just, in a second, I notice something that just grabs me. And you want to, if you can, capture something that quickly grabbed you and then reconstruct what that thing was. So you have to hold on to that first impression. Often I do that by doing a quick thumbnail sketch first to remember what I was looking at, what struck me about something. Because once you get into the sketch, you get lost in details and you need to go back to that initial inspiration.
When does the sketch become a painting?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, anytime you want, really. A piece of art or finished art, often people think of in commercial terms, what you can sell or put a frame around or exhibit. But really, I find a sketchbook is an end in itself. And a series of sketches of an experience or a vacation, even for someone who's not really an artist, who keeps a sketchbook just to document things that they see or people they love, it becomes really valuable when you look back on that and it brings back memories that you wouldn't have otherwise.
So it doesn't have to be scale. I remember going through my town in Washington County, and you were on the corner and you were painting, but it was a larger scale. I think you were painting. Maybe you were sketching. I don't know. But it was a larger scale. So that seems different than
sketching in a sketchbook.
I remember that scene. Yes. It was a street scene with cars going back on the road.
Yes.
And I did a fun YouTube video where I kind of did a cross dissolve of the actual road.
Yes.
Going into the painting. And that to me is the magic of it. We were one time back in this early days of sketching, Tom and I were on the pier in Santa Monica. We had our tape recorders with us because we loved audio tape recording. And we were sketching these two guys who said, "Draw me like a gangster." These two Mexican-American guys.
Draw me like a gangster.
And so I drew this guy, and I asked him, "What kind of car do you drive?" He goes, "69 Caprice, two spoke down." And they were telling me, and I got all this on tape, so I'm going to make a video that combines their voices with the sketches of them. And that it really comes to life when you have audio and visuals. My wife and I, Jeanette, we took a trip to England where we just brought a sketchbook and a tape recorder, no cameras. And so if we wanted to record something or remember something, we had to sketch it from life in our sketchbook. And if we wanted a sound, like an accent of a certain part of England, we had to record it.
This sounds like a very cliche question, perhaps, but is your studio more often than not outside of a physical building, or do you consider still the studio is different than being out into the world?
Yeah, my studio looks more like a video studio than it does a working studio, because I spend most of my time painting and drawing outside. It's just more fun. And it changes the pressures on you when you're working outside. You have to work a lot faster, and for some reason you make decisions quicker, and your mind tends to focus more when you're outside.
When you talk about focus, how long can that last, in the sense of do you always have the time that you need to focus and to get it the way you want it?
Well, sometimes if you're, like, I'm painting a truck, the truck will drive away in the middle of the sketch. So you have a lot of half-finished things like that. And other times, just the sun moving within 3 hours, often the light is very different. So if you're trying to capture the light, you need to come back the next day at the same time if you want to put more than 2 hours into a picture. But you know, 2 hours is a fair amount of time. So you can capture a pretty finished statement in that much time.
What do you consider your work to be these days?
Probably a lot of it is YouTube videos and, of course, books. I think I focus on three things. Substack, which is where I publish what I used to publish as a blog on Gurney Journey on Blogspot. I've sort of shifted over to Substack because the environment there is more like blogging was in around 2010 or so. That, YouTube videos, and books. Books are still very much a part of our lives, and I'm very excited to be working on books again.
So when it comes to working on a book, I mean, this is something that has been updated and returned, but when you're starting a new project of knowing much of your work that I've seen in the last several years has been in an instructional vein. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, if you want to call it that. It's instructional in the sense that I'm talking about my process, my thinking, my materials, my colors I'm mixing. And this seemed like I think when we originally conceived of the book, Tom and I thought of it as a collection of stories and a little bit of instruction. It's probably mostly instructional with a little bit of stories in the captions. One of the problems with bringing it back out again was that Tom always wanted to update it with our work we did since the book came out. I said, "Tom, if you get Rubber Soul by the Beatles, you don't want to hear about, you know, the White Album. You want just Rubber Soul or whatever they recorded they didn't release at the same time, maybe."
Yeah.
But so he never agreed to it. So I had to kind of wait until after he passed to come out with a book again. The book became very much in demand for a long time. And so we had to bring it out. So I worked with his widow and his daughters. They were great to work with.
It's a beautiful, beautiful book. It's The Artist's Guide to Sketching by James Gurney and Thomas Kincaid. It's been expanded. And
remastered and is from, what do they call it these days? Andrews McMeel?
Andrews McMeel, yeah.
Yes, used to be, I don't know what happened to Parker. AMP, Universal Media, whatever. It's a beautiful book. James, thank you very much for being with us. It's always a delight to speak to you about the process.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be here.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.